Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. It's Jesse Green here at the control panels, as always. And today, I'm excited to be welcoming back to our podcast, Selena Kulkarni. For those of you who remember, Selena was on episode 125, and Selena is the author of a new book called The Freedom Warrior. It's an Amazon bestseller, and she's a wealth advisor at phoenixwealthgroup.com.au. And in this particular podcast, we're having a really good conversation about investment, about building an income stream outside of the practice, understanding that all of us need a plan B from time to time, and building an income outside of the practice and how it changes the mindset, how we go from having to do things to going to getting to do things. It's an important mindset shift, and Selena's going to be covering that in detail during our conversation today. We also talk about a lot of work around due diligence, how to vet properties, how to vet opportunities, having rules of the game in place, understanding that we need to understand ourselves, what we're like in terms of pursuing opportunities, what we're like in terms of understanding our own risk profile. It's a wide-ranging interview, and Selena, as always, is incredibly generous. So please do have a pen and paper handy. I know you're going to get some gold out of this, and hopefully take it into your life and really apply it. Now, for those people who are new to our podcast, let me say welcome. It's great to have you here. I'd also like to let you know about the Savvy Dentist Academy, which is our new Academy. It's an online membership where you're going to have access to the latest tools, the resources, and everything you need in training and so on to help you build a practice and a life that you love. So you can head across to SavvyDentistAcademy.com for more information there. But for now, let's get on to our conversation with Selena. Here she is. Selena Kulkarni, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Once again, it's great to have you here. How are you, my friend?
Oh, terrific to be here. I'm really well, Jesse. Thank you.
Well, look, thanks so much for taking the time. I know you're at Newcastle at the moment enjoying a bit of a holiday with the family. So we'll probably hear a few birds chirping in the background, a few waves crashing with a bit of luck.
Yeah, apologies for that. I'm outdoors at the moment.
It's great. No, I think it's wonderful. Now, Selena, this is not your first rodeo on our podcast. You featured on episode 125, and in that particular episode, we had a really good conversation about wealth, wealth creation, why it's important, and so on. But for people who haven't had the opportunity to listen to that podcast yet and who may not be familiar with your particular story, I'm wondering if you could explain to us a little bit about your journey, as a chartered accountant, the business things you've done, because I think it's a really rich and interesting history. What led you to property investing in the first place?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Jesse, and quite complex, in fact. I'm not really sure where to start. I fell into accounting because I didn't know what else to do. Mm. I had actually wanted to be a veterinarian, and somehow just didn't really align for me to get to Sydney. And basically, I thought, I'll do accounting while I decide what to do. And what struck me about accounting was it is a very mechanical kind of profession. But at the same time, when I actually got into the workforce and started to be around business and I saw the play of business, I think that creative side really kind of appealed to me. And so it led me kind of out of a pure accounting profession and into more business type roles, which was really where I think my heart lies, is more of the creative entrepreneurial bent. And what I saw was, no matter how successful a business is or a business owner is, there's that unrelenting pressure to perform, to be on your best game, to not let any balls drop. And for me, the foray into investing, and particularly property investing, was almost accidental. It was something that my husband John was probably more interested in early on. And when I started to recognize that I was earning more money through my investing than I was in my job, I think that was a bit of an aha moment of like, maybe I need to put some attention here. And I kind of started to study and get very involved in that space. And then before I knew it, I guess sort of opened my mind, and I really started to go bananas with it. And I basically told my husband, step aside, honey. I'll take it from here. And he was more than happy to let me just run with it. He runs his own busy practice and just didn't have the time or the bandwidth. Yeah, I've sort of not really looked back. I've thrown myself into it wholeheartedly. I've probably done the equivalent of a PhD in property, I feel. I've worked for big developers. I've done as many different types of strategies as I could get my hands on. I've had some very expensive lessons along the way. But I think more than anything, I recognize that as a business owner, just having that ability to create a alternate stream of income, massively, it's a game changer. Like what it does to your mindset, what it does to the burden of performance on your shoulders is extraordinary. And I've seen it really change people's lives.
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating insight because it's really interesting, Selena. You and I know each other socially and personally, and you helped me with my investing and all of the things that I do. But what was really interesting recently, I had the good fortune to catch up with some friends 25 years out of university. We had our reunion and so on. And what was really interesting is there's lots of people there who are really happy and enjoying their career and doing all the rest of it. But I think there was also quite a few people who were looking to the end of the road and thinking, well, what's going to happen? How am I going to be able to wrap this up? Am I going to need to be doing this forever and ever and ever? And I think you're absolutely right. I think that that mindset shift that comes when you build that income stream outside of your practice is radical. It changes everything. Your perspective, you do things because you want to, not because you have to. So all of those things. So I want to ask you, because you did mention up front that the big aha moment for you is when you were earning more from your investments than as a chartered accountant. And yeah, chartered accountants earn pretty well. Talking small change here, we're talking decent sums of money. So I'm curious to ask you, in your own experience, what did that initial journey look like in the property investment? You said you had a few big lessons in there, a few expensive lessons. What were some of the highs and what were some of the pitfalls?
Look, people tell you that it doesn't matter when you get into property, you can make a success of it. And I definitely believe that to be true. But, you know, I was very fortunate that I got involved in property during a period where I very much rode the wave. Unfortunately, a lot of people continue to pat themselves on the back about having made a lot of money in property just because they timed it well initially. And then when maybe the climate changes as it is right now, they come unstuck. If I think back about some of those early investments, there's no doubt that they kind of propelled me to that next level of wealth and gave me opportunities to kind of dabble and try different things. We had a very painful experience probably early on in our journey where we got involved in a development that resulted in us losing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, which really, really hurt at the time. Mm. And it was one of those experiences that just even from a psychological point of view, I wasn't sure if we were going to bounce back. Mm. Any loss is difficult, but that one was not only difficult mentally, but actually difficult in the real world as well. And what that taught me, though, was the importance of building multiple pillars of wealth in a strategic way where there's really no single event that could wipe you out. And what I'm really passionate about now is not only helping other people achieve that as well, but also I'm really passionate about this idea that you should be enjoying wealth before you're old.
Yeah.
I work with dentists and people in your profession, Jesse, and I see how hard they work and how ambitious they are. But the common wisdom is that they can't enjoy it until they're in their 60s. Mm. And I think that's a tragedy. Not that 60s are old, but I really, after that initial massive loss, I kind of set about, and there were other smaller scratches and bruises, but, you know, I really kind of set out to develop, you know, wealth from the viewpoint of how can I enjoy this while I'm still young? How can I avoid those sorts of things again? How do I create wealth that's going to last 100 years instead of just my lifetime?
Okay, so there's so many little threads that I'd like to pull on and see where the conversation takes us. But what I'd really like to start with is the psychology of dealing with loss, because for many people, a significant loss like that takes them out of the game. Certainly, yeah. I'd put my hand up and say I've made possibly every mistake known to man and a few extra. But dealing with loss is really hard. You know, on a personal level, I find that really hard. I'm sure. I'm not the only one. So How did you bounce back? I mean, because a couple of hundred grand or however much it was is a big amount of money.
Yeah.
How did you find the wherewithal to go, okay, I've learned that lesson and now I'm going to, you know, be a bit smarter, a bit more cautious? How did you go forward from there?
Look, it wasn't easy at the time. I think there was still, in my world, there's always lots of opportunity. Mm. And so we had to get a hell of a lot more creative. You know, one of the things I say to people who are looking to enter the property space now is I think there's a sense of overwhelm because property's expensive and, you know, lending's not so easy. But I think when resources are limited and there's still plenty of opportunity around, that's where having a creative mind to different ways of doing things becomes very important. From a psychological point of view, I think losing money is difficult, but you have to school. It's like no other area, every other area of life. I mean, it's no different. Any kind of pain or loss, if you don't counsel yourself to find the lesson, then it will create a scar and give you baggage that you will take with you forever. And I've counseled many couples and many people over the years around loss.
Mm.
And you want to be really gentle with yourself because it's natural to want to feel pain around any kind of loss. And I've certainly worked with couples who've basically come to the verge of divorce or separation. And I know many people who have separated and divorced over a very, very small loss. And I think the main thing is to, particularly if you're investing with someone, I think that makes it easier because you can talk it through and look for the lesson. If you're on your own, I think it is more challenging. But what I would say is that I recognize that money is just energy. And if you lose money, it's a loss of energy, but it's not something that you can't recover from. And if you look for the lesson of how would I do it differently, how could I do it differently, and not become cynical and bitter about it, that's the difficulty, is to not say, well, I'm not going to trust again and I'm not going to do this again. I mean, you know me quite well. I'm a very open person and I'm quite a trusting soul, but I've definitely created some boundaries around what I will and won't do when it comes to finances now.
Yeah, well, definitely, Selena, you're probably one of the most open people I've ever met. Certainly one of the most generous as well, and definitely trusting as well. So let's talk about those boundaries, some rules of the game, if you will, some parameters. You know, I will do this and I won't do that. And of course, everyone's rules are going to be different. I understand that different people are going to have different things. But if you were thinking about how would I create some rules for myself, what sort of process should people be going through, or what things should they be thinking about as they develop their own rules for investing, as their own boundaries? And like, they're like bumpers in the, what do you call it, the 10-pin bowling, so you don't go down the gutter.
Yeah, that's right.
So how do you create those?
Look, I think the overarching rule that I've lived by for quite a while now, and I hear it often in my circle of mentors, is trust but verify.
Mm.
So I think cynicism and being negative is not really helpful in the world of investing. But I think having an open mind, trusting that something is intuitively like the right strategy, but verify every single detail is really important. And the ability to do good due diligence is literally, in my mind, what will make or break your investing experience. So when we talk about rules of the game, it's going to be different for everyone because everyone's got a unique way of thinking, a unique mindset, a different relationship to risk. And what I try and teach people are there are probably six core areas that you can kind of look at in order to develop these rules of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be flexible. You don't want to be hard and fast about it. But if you have a process that you run every single opportunity through in terms of a filter, if you like, then it's going to put you streets ahead of what most investors do, which is they invest on gut feel, emotion, somebody else's advice, flimsy research. There's so many ways that I see people investing, which they're not really serving themselves. And from where I stand, it's not really a robust methodology. And I think some of that comes from experience, but if you wanted to fast track it, I'd be speaking to people who have the results that you want and asking them, how do they do it? I would be rubbing shoulders with investors who doing the kinds of deals that you want to do and saying, what are you learning? What are you looking at? So it's all just common sense, really. But I think there's definitely I unfortunately feel in Australia, because it's such a pastime, you know, talking about property and property investing is an Aussie pastime, really.
It's every barbecue, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think what people tend to do is they invest in silos. They rely on limited information in the media, magazines, and then they go out and they pull the trigger, and it's very isolated. There are some forums and things like that, but even in that space, people are kind of not wholeheartedly talking as a community. They're talking in little silos.
It's really interesting. You talk about common sense, but common sense is not always common practice. And
true.
Everything that you said there, I'm going, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. That makes sense. As I'm sure people listening to this podcast are as well, they're going, yeah, that makes intuitive sense. But for one reason or another, people don't follow through on that common sense. What is it that you think inhibits people from doing the common sense things that you know will help them?
Greed. Full stop.
Greed.
Greed. I think when you've got dollar signs in your eyes, it can really cloud your judgment. And greed and fear are the two things that run most financial markets.
Mm-hmm.
But I think ultimately the reason that people overlook the process or the methodology is because they forget because all they can see are the dollar signs of the profit that they're going to have.
Yeah. So, Selena, you've mentioned that we need to have an opportunity filter. You've mentioned that there's a process we need to go through. You've mentioned that we need to speak to people who have got results. And I want to come back to that in a moment. But I've also heard you talk about the risk fingerprint, the idea that everyone's got their own risk profile and is different and unique to each investor. I wondered if you could just talk about that for a few minutes, because, again, there'll be people listening to this show going, oh, yeah, that sounds really easy, or I'm quite comfortable with it. And there'll be other people going, oh, goodness me, you know, that sounds hairy, scary. Could you just walk us through your philosophy? And I really like the metaphor about the risk fingerprint I've heard you speak about before.
Financial planners and other wealth advisors will often use a questionnaire to kind of put you in a box, basically, and say, you're this kind of investor and therefore you should take on this kind of investment. I find that has very limited use and is very generic. And when I talk about a risk fingerprint, really what I'm saying is you need to know yourself. You need to know who you are and what is palatable and unpalatable for you and how you relate to risk, and use that as a guide to selecting investments. So the reason I call it the risk dice, I often say, is because there's really six core areas that I think people need to focus on. And it's things like, how do you cope with loss? What is your ambition to speed ratio? Like, where do you sit there? What percentage of your assets do you have at risk? What season of investing are you in? What experience do you have? What exposure have you got in terms of whether it's familiar or unfamiliar? And I find those sorts of conversations far more useful than getting put into a box which tells me that I'm a balanced investor. Because really, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And so when I talk about risk fingerprint, I'm really saying know yourself. Like, get to know who you are. Be honest about who you are. Be honest about your tolerance for risk, for how ambitious you are. Some people try and mask their ambition when they're really aggressively ambitious, but they mask it. And so I guess to some degree, when I work with people and I'm trying to help them unveil their fingerprint, I'm really asking them to kind of reveal themselves. Who are they? What's important to them? So that you're then selecting assets with eyes wide open about who you really are.
Yeah, cool, cool. So I really love that, Sonny, because I think know thyself is important advice for life in general, investing particularly. Yeah. But just in life, I think you've got to know yourself and be true to yourself and understand that that's okay. Because one of the things I've observed is that people take their cues from others. And in today's world, that's very easy in terms of social media and other things. And we sometimes think we should be doing this or we should be doing that. Someone else is doing this, therefore I should do that. And it may be true, but it may not be, because your own profile or your own fingerprint is different to someone else's. So I really love that advice. What I wanted to ask you at the moment is, in Australia, property is quite expensive. It takes big licks of cash to get into, you know, one individual holding if you're buying it directly. What I'm curious to ask you about is, given that current market situation, and I haven't even taken into account the lending situation and the Royal Commission and all the other things, given that scenario, given that landscape, where do you see opportunity these days?
That's a really great question, Jesse. Look, I am someone who uses language around it's really important to be investment agnostic. So not to hold biases about what works and what doesn't work, but more to read the climate and then identify opportunities that work in that climate. So right now, I very much feel that the Australian market is kind of reducing. It's standing still, in some cases slightly declining. It's run out of steam. It's run out of puff. And there's a lot of investors that I'm speaking to who are in a lot of pain right now because they're completely reliant on capital growth to fuel their strategy.
Yeah.
And if you're wholly in on that particular strategy, you're going to be in pain for the next few years. There's no doubt. There's so many levers that are getting fiddled with right now that just haven't been touched in the past that are causing almost an artificial kind of environment here. And as you said, it's really expensive. So particularly if you're in your early years of investing, you can't afford to put a foot wrong. You really are, you know, every investment has to count in those early days. Where I'm focused on right now, and have been for the last decade or so, but is in the space of alternate property investments, which includes investing in overseas markets. The dollars at stake per deal are much smaller. The returns are significantly higher. And interestingly, within their markets, some of these deals are perceived as low, low risk. So it's really giving a different pathway during a time where other people are either going to sit on their hands or be panicking about what's going on in the Australian market.
Yeah, okay. So again, I hear the word alternate investing and I know there'll be someone here going, alternate sounds scary, but unfamiliar doesn't mean unsafe. Unfamiliar just means that we've got to educate ourselves in that particular market, right? Is that basically what you're saying?
Totally, exactly right. So one of the things I talk about is there's a huge difference between something being risky and something being unfamiliar. So part of the journey that I'm on with my tribe is helping them increase the familiarity so that naturally de-risks it. And once you understand something and you can understand, you've got a process for vetting opportunities, you understand how to quantify the risk, you understand all the elements, then suddenly it doesn't become unfamiliar. And so the risk kind of falls away in a different way. But yeah, I mean, the number one rule of investing for me is do not invest in something you don't understand. So I would certainly not be prescribing anyone rush out and throw a whole lot of money into something they don't understand.
Yeah.
And so the world of alternate property investing is super exciting. It's really interesting. It's a space where people who I believe, my mentors who are top of their game, they play in extensively. But if you can also get very burnt if you don't know what you're doing. So it's like everything, you know, development sites here in Australia, great coin, really exciting. But if you don't know what you're doing and the market sneezes, you can end up, you know, incurring a massive loss.
Yeah. So again, I think the big message here is educate yourself, be familiar with what you're investing in, know yourself, know the investment, have a process, do your due diligence, understand all of those things before you pull the trigger.
Totally.
I want to ask you a little bit about diversification because, you know, the whole situation of having all your eggs in one basket and maybe the one basket could be Aussie property or negatively geared property here in Australia. Interestingly enough, sorry, just on a small tangent, every time I speak to Americans, they never understand why anyone would negatively gear a property. Seems like such a foreign concept to them, right?
Yeah.
And I remember back in the early 2000s, I was listening to a guy called John Burley speak, and John was saying, yeah, only in Australia does this really kind of get a lot of traction. But putting that aside, if you are having all your eggs in one basket, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about diversification, how to diversify. Obviously, we understand the benefits of it, but what does diversification actually look like? Because for some people, it means having two negatively geared properties, one in north side of Sydney, the other in the south side of Sydney. So could you just speak to that just for a moment?
Yeah, look, great topic, great question. Look, what I know about diversification and the way that the average Joe investor understands it is don't have two investments in the same place. And exactly what you said, if I've got an investment in New South Wales, then I should have one in Victoria, and tick, I've diversified. And I think people give a lot of lip service to that word without really thinking about it. And one of the concepts that I believe strongly in is this idea of mindful diversification. Mm. And it's definitely something that we obviously talk about in our program. Mm-hmm. And mindful diversification is not just giving lip service to the idea of invest in different geographies. So geography is usually the key element that people think of when they think of diversification. Mm. But it's around invest in different asset classes, invest in different deal makers, invest in different streams of strategies, so that you bring not just one layer of diversification to it, but maybe four or five. And if you can diversify both in terms of geography and strategy and who supports you and how you get paid and the frequency of payment and the terms and conditions around each deal, then that is how you ultimately build multiple pillars of wealth, so that when the economy starts to move in a particular direction because of constraints of that particular time, you're kind of ambivalent about it. You kind of go, okay, well, I see that that might affect one of my pillars, but the rest are untouched. And that is really the secret to building wealth that is far more robust than if you are in a single asset class in a single market.
Again, I really love that. That's so powerful. Ladies and gents, if you pick up nothing else from this podcast, and there's been heaps of gold already that Selena shared, I'd really encourage you to go back and just have a listen to that last 30, 40 seconds there around diversification. Because if you're going to be investing, in my experience anyway, you want to make sure that you're safe. And part of a safety strategy is to not have all your eggs in one basket. And I think Selena's just outlined some really wonderful thoughts around that. So I wanted to ask you, Selena, a little bit around network and net worth. I know you're a bit of a proponent on understanding who's in your network, and we've had plenty of conversations over this over a cup of coffee. Can you tell me a little bit about network and net worth?
Really good question as well, Jesse. What I would say is that when you're just starting out as an investor, you've got to do all the hard yards yourself. You don't have a particularly good network. And so really, you're learning everything by yourself, you're doing everything by yourself, and you might meet a couple of people along the way, but it's a slow journey. The thing that I've learned over the years of investing is that the single biggest influence on my wealth have been the people that I've met and who have become my friends and mentors and people I rub shoulders with who are doing the same deals alongside me. And the reason that there's just no substitute for a powerful network is there's so many layers to it, Jesse. But first thing is, when I have money available to invest, deal flow just comes to me in an instant. I'm not wasting time chasing deals. Mm. Like, I have a pool of people that I can go to and say, I've got this amount of money coming up in 6 months. I want to make sure I start looking at opportunities now. And people will show me things that really are reserved for usually the ultra wealthy. Yes, your access to deal flow, your ability to learn from mistakes. When you're rubbing shoulders with people who are doing the same things that you are, they share journeys, they share mistakes. And so you can avoid mistakes. They help you prepare. Like, people have their ear to the ground. People know what's coming up economically. People hear things that are happening in government. And so you get an inside track into what may happen in the future, and you can create a defense for that because you know about it well ahead of time, instead of what most people do is, you know, the economy might tank and you're the last person to hear about it, and it's like, oh, whoops, it's too late. And so the value of a network having a huge impact on your net worth is, for me, the two go hand in hand. If I were to lose everything tomorrow, but I still had my network of relationships and friendships and mentors, I think I could get back to where I am. It would take a bit of time, but that for me has been the single biggest influence in my wealth journey over the last, particularly last 5 years, but I would say over the last decade.
Yeah, wow. Really important. All right, Selena, I wanted to ask you one last question because we're mates, and this is totally unrelated to property, but it's kind of related to property because we're talking about network and all the rest of it. I wanted to ask you, one of my favorite questions is, if you're having a dinner party, you could have four or five people over, interesting conversation, good meal, good company, all that sort of stuff. Who would you want sitting around your table?
Oh, that's a good question. I've always thought it would be interesting to have Oprah over to dinner. I think she'd just be like a fountain of great knowledge. I think I used to say I really found someone like Obama very charming. And we've named our chooks after Oprah and Obama. They're all black chickens. Beyonce.
Does Beyonce the chook have sparkles?
No, but they're probably all people I'd love to have to dinner. I think it would be eclectic. A celebrity, a George Clooney, I think he'd be a good person to have to dinner.
Yeah, but that's for eye candy.
No, I think he'd be really charming. He's super intelligent. He's charming.
I reckon my wife would be hitting you up for an invitation to that dinner if George Clooney's there. Just saying.
I think he's a pioneer in the acting world in terms of trying to have influence.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, I don't think I'd have Trump, funnily enough.
No, okay, fair enough.
Although he's very supportive for people like us who are investors.
Yep, he is. Well, he's one himself, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he would just dominate conversation is my sense. But no, that's I'm actually going to give that some more thought. But yeah, those sorts of people.
All right. So far we've got Oprah, Obama and Beyonce. I reckon that'd be a fun night. I reckon there's got there'd definitely be karaoke going on. I'm pretty sure about that.
That would be so fun.
That would be fun. Selena, you've been incredibly generous with your time today, and I want to say thank you from all of us here at The Savvy Dentist. I'm looking forward to welcoming you to client event at the end of the year in November. All of our members are looking forward to seeing you there. It's going to be epic. It's going to be awesome. I've heard you speak lots of times before, so I know just what these guys are in store for, and I'm really looking forward to that. But from all of us here today, I want to say thank you. You're an absolute gem, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your holiday to come and talk to us. You're an absolute superstar.
Pleasure. It's been fun.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Jesse.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.